have the news.
Monday, April 15th. I'm Scott Frazier. This is LA Podcast. I'm here with Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker.
We got to speed it. We've got a long...
I'm pacing it.
We got to go through this fast. We have a great conversation this episode with Carolina Miranda of the LA Times.
Right.
She talks about the new LACMA building that's being planned, all kinds of stuff related to the LA art and museum scene, as well as she's the co-chair of the LA Times Guild. She updated us on their negotiations with
Scourge
management.
Of the industrialists.
So we're going to do a quick
Carolina Miranda
intro and some stuff that's going on this week. I have a very short LA story that's related to some of the stuff we want to talk about. I have been a scooting fool the last week. I'm scooting all over town.
What brand are you using?
I'm a Lime loyalist so far. Occasionally Bird. I don't even have the Jump app yet.
Spin.
I don't have Spin either.
There's Jump too.
Really like is just one app. Thank you very much.
We probably don't even have time for this, but I'm very curious why you are a Lime loyalist.
There are just more of them around where I live. I just run into them more often.
That sounds like the opposite of being a loyalist.
Sometimes I have the choice. And for some, I will choose Lime just because it's not like fully broken for me ever.
Right.
No scooter has like fallen apart while I've been riding it. So a couple things that happened this week of scooting around. Scooted by the Trader Joe's on Hyperion.
On the sidewalk or on the street?
On the street.
Whoa, you are brave.
I know. I was following the rules, which no one does, and I wouldn't even recommend you do most of the time. And so I almost got doored to smithereens.
Yeah.
I had to slam on the brakes really hard. This guy, just like totally not looking, opened his door right into my body. I brake as hard as I can. I say, excuse me, as I'm braking, in actually a very polite way, just as like a beta. I realize I will just till the second I die, which I almost did. And the guy goes, sorry, I didn't see you, bro, in this kind of aggressive way. I just keep scooting on. I'm not interested. I don't turn around. And I guess he wanted some kind of acknowledgement that everything was cool because he was like mad at me for not engaging him more.
Wow.
And he goes, I was getting out of my car, which I was like, I wasn't questioning what you were doing. Yeah. I know what you were doing.
You also can't let go. You cannot let go of a scooter. You will fall.
You can't throw yourself off.
And you can't turn around.
In an elegant way.
But you can't even do turn signals. You can't even look back. You will fall.
Yes.
It's very unstable.
So I want to tell people something that I think is very helpful for saving lives, which is something called the Dutch Reach. A lot of people make jokes that it sounds like a gross sex thing, but what it is just opening if you're a driver, opening the door with your right hand, reaching over with your right hand. So you can
forces you to look
around and see if there's anyone coming behind you. It's just a matter of getting used to that motion, but I actually do that now. And I'd say it saved me from dooring one person over the last couple of years. I also ran into a friend since I've been scooting who told me, hey, I saw you the other day on a Segway. No, you did not. It was a scooter. Somehow to me, that is infinitely less embarrassing than us. I bought a Segway and I'm just going around the neighborhood on a Segway. Yeah, I was really, really embarrassed. And now I'm not sure I can ever use a scooter again. But this is sort of related. There's a lot of stuff been going on in LA this week related to scooters. We've talked in the past about the Rowena Road diet right next to that Trader Joe's in Silver Lake. There's been a lot of controversy over a lane for cars was removed and replaced with a bike lane and a turn lane. And a lot of people in the neighborhood have been trying to get rid of it. And this week, two things happened. One was LADOT came out with a bunch of studies and a final report that said this road diet is good. Don't get rid of it. And at the same time, there was an election for neighborhood council all over the city. And the faction of the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council that was seen as being against the road diet was thrown out. Mm-hmm. And a new slate came in who is they are vocally pro road diet.
There's also a third thing that happened.
What was the third thing?
That a group from the Los Feliz Neighborhood Council wrote a letter a while back asking for safety improvements, which may include a road diet on Hyperion, because that's where that woman was killed a few weeks ago. And David Rue is asking for safety improvements from LADOT, who was seen as maybe not fully in favor of the road diet. It was hard to see exactly, you know, his position. So it now seems like he is moving
on board.
Yeah, full steam ahead with a one continuous road diet from, let's say, Hyperion to Rowena across the Fletcher Bridge. I'm just going to keep saying it's a different story.
This is like my favorite unofficial recurring segment. Hyperion hyper local news we have occasionally.
But it's a big deal because it was one of the on a citywide scale,
yes.
It was one of the first really big moves that was made, and it's showing, the data is showing that it is working, and if anything they should add more things to it, like add more features to it, like actually separating the bike lanes, actually making the crossings safer for pedestrians, and it would be even more effective. Bike ridership went up, and probably scoots, I don't know if they counted the scoots during this period because it wasn't officially, probably it was more than a year ago that
I don't think it was a thing when they started,
but bike ridership was up 500%.
Wow.
Over the previous study time after they, that's really, that's,
we should be studying scooter stuff more here. All I read are these studies coming out of San Francisco and Portland where they really are looking at scooter use. The news has been very positive about how they are replacing car trips, and they're creating many more transit trips than they even replace.
Well, maybe we would know that if you got all the data from the companies as part of their requirement to provide this information. And Lime, maybe you can say one reason you like to ride Lime is because Lime has given all their data to the city of LA.
That's why I like them.
But some of these, some of these other companies, perhaps TNC companies that didn't maybe give their data to cities
TNC
the first
is
time
ride
around.
Share, right?
Yeah,
I always forget.
I say ride hailing because you're not
hailing, you're not sharing.
But the, some certain companies that have for a long time given people rides in the city of LA are not complying and giving their data. And this is a perfect example of if we could find out on a road diet, for example,
yes.
Or in another place that's particularly dangerous to scooter riders, if we had that data. We could make changes. A person was killed this weekend in Hollywood on a scooter. The driver was drunk and hit and run, but then they found him. Was that right?
A LAPD sergeant saw it happen.
Wow.
It was at Sunset and Vine at like 3 a.m. And it was a guy, I believe in a pickup truck, who hit someone on a scooter, and then backed over that person and then drove off, and the sergeant drove after him and caught him. So horrible news, but something that seems to have changed a little bit in how these cases are handled is the driver was immediately charged with murder.
Yeah.
Which, compare that to also in recent news, we've talked a lot about the death of Woon Fraser a year ago in South LA, was killed on his bike by a woman who drove off and then got her car painted to try and avoid being caught, but then turned herself in a couple weeks later. The woman, Mariah Banks, was only charged this past week, or like a week and a half ago.
Yep.
And she was charged with vehicular manslaughter, which I don't think is necessarily like an unfair charge. I think everyone agrees that it was an accident. But obviously the result of incredible negligence, and something that should be prosecuted. Why did it take a year? We don't know.
Right.
Sara Soliman at a Streets blog has been writing unbelievable stuff about this story, and she's really been trying to get to the bottom of why did it take a year? They said they were still assembling video evidence. I mean, we all saw the video evidence a year ago. There was nothing stopping a vehicular manslaughter charge from coming out the day she turned herself in.
And I mean, especially when you take into account the attempt to disguise the vehicle.
Pretty open and shut.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to me like that takes it out of the realm of, I mean, it's manslaughter still, but it takes it out of the realm of, you can say, oh, it was just a case of, it was an accident. Also, so does the fact that it was hit
and
run.
Well, that's a separate charge. Yes. She got vehicular manslaughter and felony hit and run, which
right.
was a separate thing. But it does indicate like the fact that the person who killed the scooter rider on early Saturday morning was charged so quickly. I think part of that was he had DUI charges in the past. And I think if you kill someone while you're intoxicated and you already have a DUI charge, you can automatically be charged with murder.
And there's a police officer present when it happens.
Yes, and you back over somebody. But I mean, the fact that the charge came out right away is a change. It's compared to what happened.
Yes, definitely.
In Moon Fraser's
So this
case.
Is our first scooter death, and I would say
second,
that
second, the someone in Santa Monica,
city of LA. I'm
sorry.
you can pretend you're from Santa Monica as much as you want. But just looking at, they have their own program. Santa Monica has their own program,
yes,
their own pilot
do.
Program. We have just launched ours. We have just launched it, and now we have a death. Right? Santa Monica has amazing bike infrastructure. Scoot, bike, whatever kind of infrastructure, and they are updating it and improving it all the time. It's you can go there and you have a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. We have to do something immediately.
Yes.
Because more people will die and people are not going to stop riding these. Everybody is riding
people
them.
People are riding them everywhere.
Yes.
They are like by the standards of usage, they are a huge success. But it has created this incredibly unsafe environment. You're not allowed to ride on the sidewalk. That's the first thing it says when you open the app. It is incredibly unsafe to ride in the street.
Feel very vulnerable.
But this week was the first time I actually felt like we are going to see changes to the streetscape. Maybe I'm an optimist, but I think it could happen really, really soon. The current situation is not sustainable at all. So either we get yet another scooter ban, which could happen, but pretty soon people are going to start just buying these. People like this product.
That is interesting.
A lot of people, I see people with them on the train, their own. You
yes.
know, a lot of people do own them,
yes.
too.
Do you feel like that, Alyssa? Like we'll get the changes to the streetscape?
One thing I did also see happen a few weeks ago was there was someone killed on Riverside Drive, a teenager, and LADOT is already putting those changes
yep.
in. There was a big vigil. There was a very high profile event that was set up. And actually someone, a driver, hit the memorial
yep.
that they had set up and hit
which
it
Which also happened in Moon Fraser's
because,
case.
Yes, which is a recurring theme here.
Yep.
And the changes are being made. We have no choice. I think something has to happen. I think it has to be the same idea that they have talked about where they're going to pilot a few bus only lanes like
yep.
very quickly. I think we need to pilot some scooter only lanes in many places, maybe just for the summer. I don't know. Like something needs to happen. It needs to reflect the change that they have allowed 11,000
right.
scooter devices to be placed on the streets of our city.
I wish that I had that your optimism, Hayes, or even your just kind of belief in the rationality of city government, Alyssa, because I feel extremely pessimistic. I don't think this has ever been a sustainable state of affairs, and yet we continue to let people die. There was that news about we're going to start putting people's names on intersections to commemorate where they die.
Bike memorials.
I'm sure they meant well.
For cyclists. There's going to be signs.
All about meaning well.
There's going to be signs that are placed at the sites where people were killed
right.
riding bikes that to remind people, these blue signs, right, bright blue band-aid on the problem.
Yeah,
I totally,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's just, I just feel extremely, because the choice is always between like doing something and just absolutely doing nothing.
I mean, and it's not incomparable. We have a city council that's very vocally anti-NRA. It's not incomparable to the NRA putting up little signs honoring victims of gun violence. The
sure.
city has created the dangerous conditions that are leading to people getting killed. And to say, like, here's a plaque.
And they actively safeguard the conditions that get people killed. So, yes, I feel pretty pessimistic about that. But I do hope that I'm wrong and you're right.
I think it's so as TNC ride hailing is increasingly used, we are at the very least less in need of parking than we have been in the past. I think like is first on the
Take
hit list
out.
On any major artery, there should not be parking along anywhere in Sunset anymore. That usage should be replaced.
I agree.
And
let's start with Hollywood where this happened, where this
yes.
person was killed.
Hollywood Boulevard.
Start with Hollywood and Sunset.
Yes.
You could take those streets. There's tons of people walking around and there's people riding scooters on the sidewalk. I work there. I see it every single day. I have rode a scooter on the sidewalk in Hollywood because I do not feel safe riding
yes.
on some of those streets. Take them out. Just pedestrianize as much as you can. It's summer. People are coming to hang out and have fun anyway. Like, let's let people survive the summer.
Speaking of a lot of pedestrians, there was a memorial this week for Nipsey Hussle. started at Staples Center. There was a huge event that people were selling tickets on the secondary market for that event for like $500.
Damn.
And ended, there was a procession that ended at the his store, his marathon store,
right.
In Crenshaw. Just this incredibly moving, all the pictures marathon and video procession. From it, it was massive.
Yeah, no, it was really incredible. Really powerful images came out of that. There was an article by Frank Zhang in the LA Times. There was also a fantastic article by Sara Suleiman again at Streets Blog.
On a quickly underscore too, how great Frank Zhang has been as a new columnist at the Times.
Great,
he is
great
a
stuff there.
Superstar.
Yeah. Yep.
His article primarily focused on the difference in the way that people see not just Nipsey Hussle, but using him sort of metonymously for the way that people who live south of the 10 in Los Angeles see South Central LA versus the way that other people in neighboring areas or in whiter and wealthier parts of the city see South LA and think about the issues facing that area. That was a really fantastic article. Sara's article, of course, she's done extremely good reporting on all things South LA for years and years now. She had incredible photos just of this deeply moving procession as it went through these various, you think about these invisible boundaries that divide the lives of young people of color in South LA from one neighborhood to the next, and just the way that people are in these pictures rolling through these neighborhoods, all coming out in support of Nipsey Hussle as really this figure of this voice of activism for what he really believed was the future of LA. And it was very, very uplifting to just read through this thread. I highly recommend people check it out.
And there was a memorial, we'll link to that and we post the on Twitter. There was a memorial in contrast to some of the signs that go up after deaths from unsafe biking conditions. There the council did a memorial to Nipsey Hussle that was very beautiful and pure, named that intersection. You have more details on this, Alyssa.
They the next day, the day after the memorial, Marquise Harris Dawson, who represents the area, gave just again, like if you want to go look for something to watch, gave a really wonderful speech, and so many people in public comment. Like I'm getting chills. Like just like you know, often our council proceedings do not
inspire chills.
Such emotional responses, but all these members of the community, so many people speaking about his impact and what he did so eloquently. And it was just a great thing to see the city acknowledging and you know, with hopefully more than just naming the intersection after him with the sign, but with
right.
following up with a real dedication to the work that he had laid out and what how the city can support that. So that it was really cool to see making it official, I guess, the next right. day, you know, it was cool.
All right, let's get into it with Carolina Miranda, LA Times reporter slash critic slash rabble rouser right now.
Okay, as you may have heard, there were some developments over the last week with a certain art institution in Los Angeles. And when I wanted to talk about LACMA, there was only one person that I wanted to have on the show to talk about LACMA with, and that is my dear friend, Carolina Miranda.
I thought you were going to say Joseph Giovannini.
I thought you were going to say Brad Pitt.
Diane Keaton.
Not available. They were not available, but and then I called Carolina. but I think, well, first of all, introduce yourself. I'm sure people know who you are. We talk about you on the show, too, which is, you know.
I am really creepy. Oh my God. Yeah. Thank you. Should I be worried? I am a Carolina Miranda. I'm a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times covering arts and culture. And I'm also in my spare time, the co-chair of the Los Angeles Times Guild, which is a whole other job that's unpaid.
Well, hopefully ultimately it results in more pay for somebody.
For everyone.
Some people. Yeah. Yeah.
One would hope.
We will definitely talk about that too. But I wanted to just for, you know, I don't think we talk a whole lot on the show about the world that I am very involved in, and you are very involved in the art slash design slash architecture. Sometimes I try to bring it up or, you know, talk about something I went to, but this felt up until very recently like a very niche topic. And then all of a sudden the last 2 weeks, like everybody started getting really interested in like what was going on at LACMA. Did you feel that way?
I think so. I think it's this process that, because of the nature of the process, because once a year, once every 10 months or so, LACMA dribbles out some new design concepts for their Peter Zumthor design campus. It has been this evolving design that I think all of us honestly were like, okay, how close do we need to be paying? Like, okay, is this the first draft? Is this, what am I looking? Are we close to the final? And I think when the environmental impact report came out and then the Board of Supervisors meeting was so closely on the heels in that, everyone was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, are we, yeah, is this really the final draft? Is this the last version of what we're looking at? And it was a version of the museum that had changed quite drastically in shape and was also 10% smaller than had been previously discussed. And as a result, will result in less gallery space than the buildings it is replacing. So I think all of a sudden there were some fires.
People really wanted to know what was happening.
People wanted to know what was happening. And I think part of what made it more mysterious is that there was no model to look at.
Yeah.
And it was all based off of three digital renderings that were released as part of the environmental impact report.
And then the vote was there. And they're like, and then the vote's on Tuesday.
The vote's on Tuesday.
For $117 million to be allocated.
Can we talk a bit about the redesign of LACMA, how this
the
came
whole
about?
The history of this project would be great.
Yeah. Because we've talked about it a little bit on this show, mostly in terms of the fact that it's this massive fundraising effort that the museum is undertaking, have been for years and years at this point. There was like a whole, people may remember, there was a whole Twitter sort of, I don't even know, firestorm about the coverage by the New York Times about Los Angeles, like desperately seeking a philanthropic class.
That's right.
Oh, yes.
A city that never quite came together or whatever.
Yeah, the LA Times sell like 2 days after that article came out. And like, that's part of the legend for me.
Yeah.
Is that article. Because it talked about the Times.
It's on the Times. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That story was about the Times and it mentioned LACMA as part of it.
Right.
You know, why wasn't anybody stepping forward to save the Times from the, you know, the trunk dude bros.
Exactly.
Chicago.
So now we have a new vision of LACMA that you very memorably compared to a coffee table.
I think it was the original one.
Yes, I remember your comparison for the original one.
The original one was the best.
Yes.
That was the Cylon based star.
Yes. Of course.
Well, I mean, to go back, the history.
That was a compliment. We gotta go way back.
A compliment. It was a compliment. I want to go way back because LACMA has been trying to redesign this mess of a campus for a very long time. And it actually started in the 90s or early 2000s under director Andrea Rich. And there was a competition and Rem Koolhaas put forward this proposal that would have involved, you know, knocking down all of the William Pereiras and the Hardy Holtzman Pfeiffer edition from the 1980s and doing this massive tented structure that interestingly united the entire collection in one building rather than fragmenting it into these pavilions the way it currently is. And that died because of the recession and the fundraising just wasn't going to be there.
That was going to be like a tent, right?
Yeah, it was going to be like this tented, translucent, I mean, at least in the renderings. I mean, who can, sure, renderings are,
who knows?
Every rendering is translucent. Yes. Like no building has mass in a rendering. It's always like, don't worry, it's super see-through. It won't bother, this 80-story tower won't bother anyone or cast any shadows ever. So that plan was issued and then it died because of fundraising issues, cut to Michael Govan. And I think part of it has been this long running desire to replace
the new director.
Part of it has been this long running desire to replace those Pereira buildings, which are leaky, have never been that hospitable to art. The atriums had to be walled off to meet fire code. They're not up to seismic code. And honestly, as somebody who has worked in a William Pereira design department store as a teenager, they feel just like being in department stores. I always kid around that going into the Amundsen building was like, oh, Southeast Asian art on three, ladies undergarments on four.
That's true.
You know, it's just
not that inspiring.
It feels nostalgic though now. I don't dislike that about it almost because it feels like a throwback to being in a department store.
Some of the older things will be kept. I mean, it's not like they're keeping like at least one pavilion, which is I think, kind of cool and throwback and
the,
interesting.
The brisk off.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's not like they're raising the whole, right. all the old, you know, that was there. They're doing what they can.
But
yeah.
then enter Peter.
But then enter Michael Govan and Peter Zumthor. And I think Michael Govan has been wanting to realize a project with Peter Zumthor since he was at DIA. Michael came from DIA, the DIA Foundation in New York City. And Zumthor does not enter competition. So
lives on like the top of a mountain.
He lives in a mountain in Switzerland.
Like a spring. Yeah.
You know, part of the narrative with Zumthor is, you know, he's always likened to this kind of like Swiss hermit who descends.
Monk. Yeah. I've heard of monk. Yeah.
Who descends from the mountain to bestow us with his vision.
With his Cylon base.
Yeah,
exactly. Thus spake Peter Zumthor.
Thus spake Peter's like, dong, dong.
But he hasn't spoken at all, really, in the last few years, which is very interesting on this topic.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, the plan emerged. The economy was getting better. I think Michael really saw this as an opportunity to realize this plan that LACMA has been trying to undertake now for roughly almost 20 years to replace those buildings, which, by the way, are like have been as much as nostalgia as we might feel towards them. They didn't even make the original Gebhardt in Winter.
Oh, yeah. So interesting. Like, they were deemed too ugly to be in this like Bible of architecture that was published, you know, around the same time. So people.
They've had, serious diss.
Yeah. Oh, wow. They're in there now.
But yeah. And they had these reflecting pools at the beginning, and then the reflecting pools were a disaster because the tar would bubble up from the tar pits into the reflecting pool. So they quickly had to get rid of William Pereira's reflecting pools because instead it was this like foamy tar mess that was like bubbling.
Such a metaphor. Okay. Such a metaphor.
So it seems like that informed the original Zumthor design to have it already look like a gross pool of tar.
Right. I will say that I was excited about the original. So in 2013, they make the announcement that Peter Zumthor has been chosen, and he reveals his first design, which, you know, was variously described as the ink blot, and which I likened to the Cylon Bay Star, and that overhead looked like this pool of tar, which I was really excited about because I think one of the things LACMA has always done is the forefathers of our great city, in their great wisdom, decided to put our priceless museum objet on a tar pit. They, like, Zumthor recognized that that's what that land is and that he was going to draw inspiration from his design for that. And I was like, engage those tar pits with the fiberglass
it's so
mammoth.
Weird. I mean, the transition is you're coming from one part, you know, and I don't even think many people even go to LACMA, maybe knowing that that's coming, like that you're going to come around the corner and there's a mastodon like coming around the corner.
It smells like you're dying.
like bad hard boiled eggs.
Yes.
And that's what I liked about it too. I mean,
it's so low rent. The whole thing is super low rent.
It was a big swing, that design. What I always worried about is that it looked like in the summer it could maybe heat to 300 degrees.
But that's why they had solar panels on the top of it. It was meant to be this. He's very like sensitive to like, you know,
environmental.
Yeah, he's like, he's all about it. So it was supposed to be like an energy generating machine.
What about humans being able to just like touch it without going to the hospital?
Without like, you know, like grabbing a door handle in Phoenix in summer. It's like so I think that clearly became evident that the black as sexy and as Cylon based starish. Mm-hmm. I was watching Battlestar Galactica, rewatching it on Netflix at the time. So that's what that. Why I saw,
and that's how long ago it was.
And that's how long ago this has
been happening.
It's
a lot less of a consideration in space. The whole black surface thing,
or in Switzerland, maybe. Like who knows? Yeah,
I kind of like the design more conceptually with the whole implication that La Brea is just the tar is just gonna come up and seize all of the art back down into the earth.
Exactly. This is not yours. Yeah,
I always thought that tar pit with the fiberglass mammoths in it was like a real lost opportunity for the museums. I mean, there should be some like crazy motherfucking like Paul McCarthy thing be floating around that pond. I mean, you could just really go to town.
Yeah,
like with that thing. But so the museum has always given it its back, and so he comes out with this design, and it was problematic for a number of reasons. The color being one, it was going to create this heat island effect. And then the other issue was that he had extended this finger of the building that was going to cantilever over the main tar pit. And the concern was that it was going to not only throw shade onto this area that, you know, has these apparently vibrant microorganisms. I don't know my little ice age very well, I will confess right now. So it has these like vibrant microorganisms that scientists study. And there was concerns about what that could do. And then one of the things that came up is that, you know, there's still a lot of excavating and archaeological studies that are going on in that area.
But the Purple Line is doing most of basically.
They pull out a skeleton like every day. Yes. There. Yeah,
exactly. Those are the fundraisers of LACMA Pass. Yeah. So I think part of the concern with scientists too was like, they don't know what they're going to be digging for in 10 years or 20 mm-hmm. years. So yeah. they want to keep the area as clear as possible. And so that forced the design to change. And so the subsequent iterations that we've gotten in, 2014, 15, 16 or 17, there's been at least four major ones.
Four major.
Ever since then, the museum has jumped Wilshire into that parking lot mm-hmm. across the street, and it bridges Wilshire. And the first version of it was a blob. In fact, like still the architectural record, I think, described it
the
as
blob. The blob just like shifted. Yeah, just
kind of oozed, yeah, it oozed across the Wilshire into a parking lot. And it was this like bubbling blob. Mm-hmm. And then it got the boomerang shape, and then it got a little bit harder edged. Boomerang.
And it got lighter. It got maybe not all the way light.
It got like a sandstone.
Yeah, it was sandstony and kind of like a hazy glass, maybe like a, you know, like a tinted, a little bit of a tinted glass. Mm-hmm. And now
it's this very agreeable cream color, which, you know, these are renderings. So again, renderings bear as much reality to reality as, I don't know.
Reality.
My understanding per the museum is they are still working on exterior treatments. There's all of these studies going down about what kind of concrete they're going to use and what color it will be tinted and so on and so forth. So I think what we're seeing is an attempt to lighten the color, and I think some effort to match a little bit some of the colors going on campus already, so that you don't have a bunch of cream colored buildings and then this is the off white one.
And let's just also note
that doesn't match, you know, perfectly.
And the ones they're tearing down are also cream colored, which I think people were kind of
there's a lot of creaminess.
There's a lot of
going
cream.
On.
It's very cream.
This, I think that brings us basically to the present, where a week or 2 weeks ago, we had the release of the final environmental statement for mm-hmm. the building. That was where we got the detail about the reductions in size. Is it the case that I feel like I've read that we still don't have the exact layout of like what the floor space would look like or how the galleries would be arranged? It's mostly the
exterior
that has been released at this point. Is that right?
Yeah. There's still, I think, some major details that we are waiting on. One is a floor plan. What is this thing going to...
Hugely important for an art museum, you would think.
Especially because the original one had such an innovative take on how they were going to carve up this blobular space mm-hmm. into galleries.
Blobular.
I'm using that word. And they also had, I will say, when they first announced this in 2013, they had a museum exhibition of the plans, the model. They had an event. They had, it was on public display for months and months and months. Mm-hmm. And this time, nothing.
Like, no, and in fact, the model is going on display tomorrow. At
today.
LACMA. Or today. Today or tomorrow.
Well,
when this comes out.
It's
out right now.
Sorry, you guys. this week, when the model is put on display, a whole week after the
Are you
going to
be camping out to get a first look at it?
I actually got a sneak peek of it the other day.
You did?
I did. So here's the thing. We're still waiting on a floor plan. Still waiting on exterior color and material treatments. They are still studying because, like, for example, one of my big questions is you have this. Zumthor has done a lot of very small museums out of this raw concrete with like terrazzo or concrete floors. And those environments can be very ethereal and temple like. One of my concerns with it is what does that play out over 100,000 square foot building? Mm-hmm. Because that's a very hard surface for a body to be looking at art for several hours.
Yeah.
Like the acoustics can be pretty harsh. Huh. You know, the materials are pretty harsh. And what does it feel like to hang out in a 100,000 square foot warehouse, for example?
Or parking garage.
So I think those materials are still being determined. The floor plan has not been released. I think what we have now is the model presents a more detailed version of what was seen in the environmental impact report, which is that shape, but not in the color, that a final color. And then I think there's still all of these questions of how will the underneath areas of this massive structure be treated, because I think one of the long running questions is, okay, this could be an elevated building on Pilates that in a city like Los Angeles provides like essential shelter and shade, and especially in summer could be really pleasant. But depending on the treatment, it could also feel like you're sitting under a freeway underpass. Like, right. What's that yeah. underneath area? Like, that's a whole other surface the museum yeah. is going to have to contend with. So what that is going to look like, and where the cafes and the services are and those things, like what will that public space underneath the building look like? That is still an open
and my huge
question.
My huge concern was that when this opens, the Purple Line station will be right there, and you'll have people. It'll be on the far side of the street. It'll be, you know, it's opposite Urban Light, and then you've got what you climb up into the museum, and you go over to the other side. You go over the overpass to the old parking lot, and then you might not want to go back up through the museum and come back. You might want to walk over. So we have to make sure that whole area has to be pedestrianized, very safe, like amazing, like the best crosswalks and crossings possible, or just ban cars completely from Wilshire, from that area. And none of that.
That's what they're going to do.
Yeah. Scooters.
That's the one.
The Peterson Automotive Museum. You'll never let that happen. But I just can't believe that there was, and this has never been part of any rendering, even from like 2013. It's always like, ooh, fast taillights zooming by this thing. And I always was so concerned that this Swiss architect was like, I get to do something for Los Angeles, the area of cars, you know, and just kind of like glorified our car culture. And that's really what nobody wants. I mean, even the Peterson Automotive Museum people probably do. They want like a great pedestrian environment for this whole area. And that's nowhere in the plans ever.
Yeah. We haven't seen how that underneath area of the bridge part of the museum is being treated. What is the building going to look like in what is now the parking lot area? Is there, I mean, my understanding that area of the building will have a theater, the theater that is currently now the Bing Theater, a reduced version of that theater because it's much smaller.
Four seats.
Yeah. Get some bean bags and a projection and over and out. No, it's a 300 seat theater. And so there are so many questions about all of these elements, these refinements that are going to be crucial to what this thing looks like yeah. on Wilshire Boulevard. So we now have a model that is on display, but it still doesn't fully answer some of these yeah. questions.
Mm. Is it weird with all of these yeah. questions that the money has been spent or like has been allocated already for this project?
I personally find it a little strange. You know, some people in city politics seem to think this is normal, and I don't necessarily accept.
Well, what everybody kept saying in the hearing, and I think even Brad Pitt brought this up at the supervisor meeting, where there were literally like a LACMA bus brought up of wealthy donors, employees, celebrities. I'm sure they were all on a bus together. I'm sure they didn't drive.
It was a party bus.
I think they took Metro, obviously, because that's all they talked about was how great Metro was going to be for the museum. But a lot of people brought
up their SUVs idled outside. Yes.
Oh, God. But they all brought up, oh, remember when Disney Hall went through this approval process, right? And they were like, it looks so different from how it ended up. And everybody was a hater at the beginning. Yeah, but then everybody, everybody came around at the end, whatever. But the city is so different than it was then. You know, a lot of things have changed. And I think this idea that we should get more transparency is not a big ask.
Like, it's
this
not unreasonable. No, it's not. And I also think that people knew what Disney was going to look like when, you know, it started to move forward on the money and construction front. I mean, right. We're looking at half of LACMA is now closed. They're going to start tearing stuff down next year. Mm. And there are still a lot of hovering questions about how this is going to work and how it's not going to work. And, you know, there's a part of me that it's like the way Michael talks about, like, yes, this is a risk. This is an unusual design. You know, do we want to build the same type of encyclopedic museum that we've been building all through history? Or do we want to try something new? And I'm in favor of trying something new. And, you know, there's a part of me that is interested in exploring that idea, because it's true. Encyclopedic museums are, you know, they emerge.
Explain what that is if people might not know the actual term.
Yeah, encyclopedic collections are collections that draw from all over the world in all periods in time. And oftentimes they are shaped by a Western point of view. And so the story of art and culture in those places generally begins with the story of European art. So you go to the Met and you go up that, you know, New York, and you go up that grand staircase, and what's the first thing you see is European paintings, and everything else seems to emerge out of European paintings. And then you have these little corners where you have like you know, art of Islamic nations tucked away, or maybe some Japanese Edo era art, the Latin American gallery, and things aren't always very connected. They tend to exist in these silos. And I think what Michael is trying to do with this project is, you know, first of all, cultures do not exist in silos. And it's important to get people to think about, you know, while Velázquez was painting Las Meninas, like what else was happening in Latin America that maybe shaped part of Spain's vision at that moment in time. Like, those are important questions to consider. And I think it's important at this time that we're thinking about, like, decolonize museums and rethink whose narratives we're presenting. Yeah. And as a Latina who's very interested in Latin American art, especially in a place like Los Angeles, you know, that used to be Mexico, for a museum to really rethink the nature of how an encyclopedic museum tells a story, I think that's a really interesting debate to have. But I want it to feel more like a debate and not a done deal that's right. presented to me on a platter.
And what was also kind of, I think, I don't want to say alarming, but it was kind of jarring how much they talked about the reliance on these satellite campuses and these, like, other properties that they're going to be putting a lot of money into. Like, in South LA, there's a space next to MacArthur Park, and they, although they just closed the one at the, or no, that's MoCA, never mind. And there's one by MacArthur Park. There's other ones.
They have one at the old Otis campus, White Elementary School, which LACMA has operated for years. They've operated the gallery there. And I've done stories. That is actually a great little space that I know they were working on to give an independent entrance. Because right now, the only way you can access that space is through the elementary school. Yeah. So if you're a visitor, it's a little bit of a pain in the neck, and you got to get cleared. But they do great exhibitions there. And then they really engage the kids with the programming, and they get contemporary artists to come in and work with the kids and make work together. And it's this really great way of taking the collection off campus. And I'm not necessarily opposed to the idea of thinking about satellites in that way, but I also don't necessarily, part of what an encyclopedic museum does is tell all of these cohesive stories in one place. So what does that mean before you get into satellites, which don't really exist yet, and I'm not sure that they will? Like, what story is the main franchise telling?
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's still being worked out.
I'm really curious. You mentioned that the debate about how an encyclopedic museum should function, how it should relate to the community that surrounds it, in this case, Los Angeles, is something that you think should be happening. Are these discussions that are currently going on? And if so, like, where are they happening? Because when you say that, that is the first, like, talking about reimagining the way that LACMA arranges all of its art and the way that we think about the perspective from which we are presenting art. That sounds really interesting. And also, I've never heard anybody talk about this LACMA project on those terms. Is that?
I think it's certainly a debate that has entered museum circles and art writing circles. It hasn't really extended beyond that, which is unfortunate, because, like, why not do a symposium, you know, public, for LACMA to say at this point, do a public symposium drawing on expertise from all over the world to debate this issue would be really interesting. Because it's true, they are at this moment, like, a lot of museums are bound to this old way of showing things, partly because the hardware within which they operate only offers that kind of infrastructure. Like, you can't just come in and redo the Met, because the Met is built a certain way. Whereas now they have this opportunity to build a building that would be more purpose-built for this type of thinking. And I think that there have been debates within the art world and in academia. Like, for example, one of the things that comes up is how in American museums, Latin American art and American art often exist in often completely separate wings, even though in the Southwest, our colonial experience was a Spanish colonial experience. It was not a British colonial or Dutch or French experience that, and to kind of separate them almost puts it as the separate history that did not happen here, when in fact it did happen here. Yeah. I mean, we're sitting here in this, like, Spanish style house, you know, and so to rethink those categories, those silos in which we put things, I think is a valuable enterprise. The thing is, you also have to think about, like, museum study and the scholars who get their degrees who are then going to curate these shows. Like, there's a whole system that has to be considered with it. And that system isn't going to change just because one museum has rearranged the furniture.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting when you get into starting to talk about the hardware that is the actual museum itself, because it becomes really easy to see why there is so much angst about the proposal that is currently on the table right now. When we talk about actually rebuilding from the ground up an institution like LACMA, which is, you know, of such a magnitude in LA and also nationally, it's you start to think, well, the way that LACMA exists currently, not only is it for a specific reason, but also it has, you know, it accrues people who understand the relationship that the museum has with the collection that it has. And when you start talking about redoing that from scratch, do you fear that you're going to lose some of the context that has been gained over the years?
There could be a loss of context. There's also the issue of how do you tell that story and who are the experts who are in the position to tell those story? Because the way art history studies currently work is that they art history in universities very much encourages those silos. You know, you study Italian painting, you study Mexican colonial art, and you kind of operate within these very narrow areas. And so then what does that mean to be that curator and then go work at a museum where you have to organize an exhibition, say, looking at 17th century art from across the world? Are you prepared to do that?
To like look at that slice of time and make those.
Exactly. And so, or paperworks from, you know, the turn of the 20th century or during industrialization, like, are you ready to do that sort of thing, especially given the nature of much art history and that is still very sort of driven towards the narratives of Western art, especially here in the United States. So what does that mean? And I feel like those are debates that have not been, that they might be happening in these like more arcane art historical communities, but I don't think they have quite busted out into the public. And I think it would be worthwhile to have that discussion. I would want to see a public museum having a public discussion about what that means. And, you know, if they want to be radical, well, what are some of the radical steps they can take? Not just in terms of being sort of very fluid about the timelines of art history, but maybe making a statement, you know, that, you know, Latin American art will be as important to this museum as the traditions of Western painting because of where we are.
I have a question about the software and new art that's coming out of LA, because it does feel like most of the conversation around art in Los Angeles is about museum buildings, usually in the context of something going horribly wrong, you know, a place like The Broad is sort of not really about new art, like new local artists. It's more of like an Instagram playground.
It's whatever Gagosian is selling.
Yes, right. or like you hear about a museum director being suddenly overthrown and and replaced by Klaus Biesenbach. I just like that name. I want to say that name on the show. It's very Klaus Biesenbach. The Hammer does the Made in LA show every couple of years, but like, are we producing new artists in LA? What is going on in the art scene here beyond like Metro murals and things like that?
I mean, the art scene here has just been extraordinarily lively. Unfortunately, what happens is the narrative, you know, it seems like it's not LA if some cultural institution is not on fire.
Right. You know, that's like, what people focus on.
Yeah, yes. Ed Ruscha was right. Painted that back in the 60s. He's like, let's just torch this because this is what's going to happen anyway. You know, I think there's some incredibly strong and interesting stuff happening that sometimes gets drowned out by these headlines. And so, for example, MoCA has, as a base of its collection, has the Giuseppe Ponza collection, which is this really important collection of post-World War II art on which it has built in the decades since. They acquired that in the 80s, I believe. And the Hammer has always been known as, you know, the kind of avant-garde place, which is where you're going to see what's new and what's being made now. I think the Made in LA show is certainly evidence of that, and I think has brought their work to the forefront in a way that, you know, there's sort of solo artist shows or other more you know, deeper, more difficult group shows. They're known for like showing difficult contemporary art. So I think they're, you know, and I think LACMA has done a good job of engaging Latin American art and Latino artists. They did, you know, for the first PST, they did, Rita Gonzalez there has just curated some, she's in charge of the contemporary art department. She has curated some incredible shows of Chicano art and contemporary art for LACMA, making it a really important repository of that type of work, because a lot of contemporary art museums, you know, even the Hammer and MoCA have kind of ignored Chicano artists. So LACMA has been really important in that regard. Things like their collection of Middle Eastern art is also really important. And when you think about the influences that Middle Eastern art had on Latin American art and architecture, it's a really interesting intersection of topics to explore there. Like one of the things that LACMA has in its collection is an 18th century room from a Syrian house in Damascus. These like incredible, incredible pieces that haven't really seen the light of day because they simply haven't had the room or the space to show them.
Now they'll have less.
Now they will have less. Exactly. Like, they can show it in a satellite.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, yeah, and they did actually say, like, we are going to put art into trucks and drive them around, like these roving galleries. And I was just like,
oh, you love that.
It just doesn't seem like it's an actual
automotive museum.
Outreach is great. Yeah, the actual Peterson Automotive. But I love everything that you said about the context. Like, the context is critical, and especially putting it on a truck and like taking it to the West Side, you want to be able to wander and get lost and see. And I do understand, like, the insistence of maybe having it all on one floor might, you know, facilitate that. Might be a thing, you know, that might work. I guess, like, the other thing that I keep tripping up on is this idea that only the Swiss architect could deliver such a thing. And again, the world has changed a lot since maybe he had decided on him before he even came to LACMA. Apparently, Michael Govan wanted to have him design this museum. So he's, you know, huge fan. But we have so many LA architects who could bring maybe the sensibility that you're talking about and address a lot of these issues from inside.
And I think with Peter Zumthor especially, because, you know, he's this artist, he's this architect whose work is like grounded in, you know, phenomenology and experience and light and manipulation of environment. And
that's a Brad Pitt side.
Go in and, you know, just
light
trip,
and shadow.
Trip your brains out and come out a different person on the other end.
Okay, now I'm for it.
Yeah, exactly. Mix that with some medicinal weed and we can just all be reborn.
Why can't we just get Terrell, you know, like everything can just look like that Drake music video.
Selfie magnet.
Exactly, right? Yes.
So there is that kind of hushed reverence that constantly, accompanies Zumthor's work, that can make a Latina like myself a little uncomfortable, because it's always like, oh, you know, this European sage from the mountain will come show us the way.
And I'm like, it sounds just really? Like what you're talking about the way we're displaying art right now. It needs to change, right?
It needs to change. And so, for example, I was in Houston in December and will eventually work on a much delayed piece about the new Manil Drawing Center by Johnston Markley, a very different type of building. It's a very small building. It's designed only for drawings and the conservation of drawings. So it has a very specific program, but a remarkable building in which to see art, and also for the staff to work, because it has staff offices and a conservation lab as part of it. And it is really interesting to see what they did with this space.
They're LA architects. I don't know if
they are LA architects. Yeah. Sharon Johnson and Mark Lee. And in fact, they're going to be doing the new Institute of Contemporary Art in Philly. They just got that commission. I don't know if that's a ground up building or an extension, but they are somehow involved in that. And so I think it's interesting to see the talent that is here, that sometimes LA is so busy looking elsewhere for its solutions that sometimes...
Or at Frank Gehry. If we're looking here.
You know. Exactly. If Frank can't, he's 90. Yes. We need to just
let him live his life.
He's doing the river. Yeah. He's kind of busy.
Frank is busy. He's got shit to do.
LA County's other big...
I'm allowed to swear here, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank God.
I'm curious because, like, okay, so this is... It's very experimental. It's the kind of thing that, if successful, will be a centerpiece of LA going forward for decades. If it's unsuccessful, it still will be.
It'll be down the block from the Peterson.
Yes. Right. Spitting distance.
And the Lucas.
So, I mean, $650 million, like, you have to kind of get this right the first time. There was in the LA Review of Books a very condemnatory take on the whole process that has led to this design. I'm curious what you think about that. It was fun for me to read. It's not often that you, at least not often that I read pieces about the present day art scene where it's just like,
unnamed sources being like, that's too hot for me to say my name on record. But people were very much saying, like, you know, this whole thing has been kind of predetermined in a way that's not necessarily good for the institution or the people who are, you know, the public beneficiaries of this collection.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, it's something Christopher Knight has said too in the pages of the LA Times, just to tout our own critic, just because, right, I think that LA Review Books piece raises a lot of interesting questions, but with a lot of interesting unnamed sources.
Yes.
And
a lot of unnamed sources.
All unnamed sources, yeah, except for Michael Govan, in a way that makes me rather journalistically uncomfortable.
Right.
So I think that, yeah, this is this whole process, the preordained nature of it is a problem. And I think we were all kind of cruising along, and these renderings would be kind of dribbled out every so often. And the LA Times has been on fire for a little bit, so probably we were not watching that, right, burner,
well,
as closely.
There's no architecture critic right now at the
LA Times.
There's
no architecture critic.
Which is...
I'm pinch hitting.
Yeah. Poor Carolina has to report on it and then be the critic of it. Like, you have to report on the story, then 2 days later be like, and here's my analysis. Yeah. Like, that's really hard. But I do think that has a lot to do with it. I mean, there aren't as many full-time art critics and architecture critics working at local publications anymore to be the watchdogs.
There aren't
for
as
things.
Many local publications.
Well, I mean, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was like, you know, 2 years ago was the Annus Horribilis of media in the LA mm-hmm. Times. Like, LA Weekly was decimated. LAist was shut down. LAist is now back. But then it's like that kind of reporting, that kind of going into the 990 statements and picking through the trash and cultivating sources on that level is, you know, a mass undertaking that requires a lot of time.
Yeah.
It requires a lot of time and resources.
Right.
And it's something we have not had a lot of
at
any publication here in the LA
Great segue.
Let's
talk
about
labor
that.
Uprising.
Woo.
So you've got
put on my guild co-chair.
Yeah,
you've got your, you walked in, we're taping this on, did I say taping, recording?
Yeah.
There's no tape here.
We can say tape.
You're be like, retro. I'm old school.
Do not call it time-based media.
You walked in here with your Festival of Books, you know, pass
lanyard.
On, right? Your lanyard, your LA Times, and the great, amazing festival that they put on. And you had, you know, it's a festival where the LA Times puts together this incredible festival of books and
celebrating creativity and writing.
And there was an interesting, I think, point that you made about what the paper's staff is actually going through right now in relationship to, say, the intellectual property that you might create when you publish a book.
Exactly. Well, we are in the process of, you know, for those who need the quick history, we unionized early last year. We got a new owner last June. We moved to El Segundo. We got the owner in April and then we moved to El Segundo in June. Early last fall, we started negotiating our first contract. And as part of that, and I'm co-chair of the guild and I sit on the bargaining committee as well. So part of my joy in life is sitting in 10-hour meetings with lawyers, which I don't recommend. And one of the proposals that emerged recently was that the company issued an intellectual policy proposal that was draconian, to put it mildly. Like, they essentially wanted to own anything that could remotely, not just from things that we wrote for the LA Times, which the LA Times owns the copyright on that, but on books we might do on the side, any derivatives of those books. So if, you know, my book on the LA art world turns into a smash bestseller and some
your LACMA,
major
LACMA
Hollywood.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
The next Bosch.
By LACMA Harder.
Brad Pitt options your LACMA story.
LACMA Harder. I already have the name.
basically anything that you like would produce having learned about it.
About it through my beat.
Through
they
yeah.
wanted to potentially own and then definitely own any derivatives. So yeah, if a movie, a TV podcast approached us after this thing was published and, you know, they wanted to acquire rights to do it, the company was going to insert itself in a process, which creates a lot of problems because any books that staffers do are they do on their unpaid time, not on LA Times time. Those books are not paid by the LA Times. And they're paid by a publisher. And usually they are ideas that might emerge in your reporting, but that often don't. You know, we have staffers that write novels, they write cookbooks, they have, you know, they write all, we have a copy editor that's like an amazing quilter and ultimately wants to write a book on quilting. So, you know, it just raised all kinds of questions of like, okay, if I've at some point in my life at the LA Times edited or written a story about quilting, does that now give the LA Times rights over any book I do?
It seems facially indefensible to say, for the company to say, because you worked here and you interacted with the people that you did, that's the reason why you're able to create whatever, and we want all of that credit. We want all the money. We want everything that comes out.
Well, I mean, I would go so far as to say, even if you do write a book that is, to a larger extent, the product of your reporting, I always cite Ghetto Side by Joe Levy, which I think is one of the best nonfiction books ever. And that she was able to write that because she was embedded in these police stations for years while she was working for the LA Times. You satisfy your LA Times contract by writing articles for the LA Times. That's the job. Stuff that you are doing on the side.
Can we bring you to bargaining?
I mean, I'm a TV writer, and the idea of not being able to own your work to that extent, like have no rights to the material, would be absolutely unheard of in this industry. I mean, it's just
it would set and it really sent a ripple through the newsroom, and it would set, first of all, it would set industry standard, a new low in industry standards. It is unlike any intellectual property proposal that exists in any news guild contract or any other media contract anywhere. The company did come back with, we counterproposed, and then they counterproposed this week, and they did come back with a softer version of it. So they are now recognizing that maybe that books we write in our own time should maybe belong to us, but they are still making a grab at derivative rights if that book emerged out of a story I wrote for the LA Times. And, you know, that's still a problem because so many people's book agents have told us that, you know, how am I going to sell this project anywhere if people know that the derivative rights have already been locked up before, you know, ink has been put on paper?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to handicap projects to, like, they just will not happen. And writers, like, fewer writers will do them in the first place, knowing that they won't have the rights.
Yeah, you're going to have several effects. Is, I think, writers leaving because they want to do their book project and just don't want to deal with the bullshit. Mm-hmm. The second effect you're going to have is writers not wanting to write about certain things for the paper so that they don't put themselves in the position of writing a book. I mean, I've already gotten questions from writers. They're like, oh, I did one piece on this subject. Does that mean like the company owns my book? And that is just not a creative, you are not creating a creative place when your writers are afraid to cover subjects for you because you're going to come in and eat up all their intellectual property rights on the back end.
And it's not just the writers. I've been trying to option an LA Times story, which they told, when I initially tried to, they said, don't even bother until the sale goes through. So that slowed down the project forever. And now the prospect of having the LA Times be sort of an additional production entity on a project. Am I getting notes from the LA Times studios on something? I don't really want to deal with that.
You should acquire the rights before our contract goes through.
Unfortunately, we all just fired our agents. And so
that's not going to be,
I cannot do anything for myself. So
the upshot is that If this were enacted, regardless of whether or not the journalists are not covering specific things for the Times so that they can write about it on their own free time, or they do write about it for the Times and then the additional material that they have doesn't get published either way, it's clearly impoverishing the culture. I feel like every time we talk about this, we have a new example that we can give. Everybody has been talking about the Theranos documentary on HBO, you know, it comes from Bad Blood, from the Washington Post reporting. From the Wall Street Journal.
It's one of those W papers.
Yeah. Somewhere in the East. I love this show because I get to give myself the largest pass for just not caring about things that don't happen in LA.
I'm with you.
So you look at things like that are these, that spur these large conversations within our culture, and the thought of not actually having access to those cultural touchstones is hard to process.
Imagine.
Really.
And I think, you know, part of it stems from the fact that our new owner, Patrick Soon-Shiong, comes from biotech, in which, you know, the company owns all of your research.
Right.
And
I would say that worked for him.
And yeah, that did work for him. In fact, he left UCLA to do it privately, so it would work for him even better. And I think I think that there's a little bit of that attitude, but I think trying to translate the two scenarios mm-hmm. doesn't quite work if you're working on a very sort of specific research related to some compound that you're making for cancer treatment. It's very different than a reporter who is generally working in a beat and exploring all kinds of ideas and not a very specific treatment. Like the end goal on biotech is to get the treatment or to get the drug or to do the, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, gene therapy. And so it's a very different, it's a much more fluid world of ideas and his policy, I think to some degree does not consider everything that we bring to the Times. You know, there's underlying this policy is this idea that the Times is providing us this platform for us to enrich ourselves as writers and gain all this knowledge, which is not untrue. But I also came to the Times in my 40s as a fully formed human being with a lot of ideas mm-hmm. about the world that the Times in no way supported or paid for. Yeah. And I fucking own them.
Right. Yeah. Like, and you weren't compensated like retroactively for coming up with all those ideas beforehand.
In fact, as the LA Times pay equity study revealed last year, yes. Women and minorities at the LA Times get paid less than everyone
Imagine
else.
That.
So
Imagine.
Not only is the LA Times not paying for all the previous knowledge I'm bringing to the table, I'm probably being underpaid for the knowledge.
Can you talk about that? Because that's another big issue in the current negotiations. Like, where are you guys at with pay equity?
That is something we will probably have to resolve after the contract has been done. We have been working on the issue of pay, but pay in relation to the whole staff. Mm-hmm. They have refused to bargain the issue of equity at the table. I think partially because if they were to sit down and admit that there is an equity issue, it could create a tremendous legal liability. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're like, okay, one thing at a time. Like, yeah. Let's get the contract in place. And then once we have the contract in place, we will also have things like a grievance and arbitration system. We'll mm-hmm. be able to do information requests, like produce further studies and see how much, for example, once the new pay grid goes into effect, how will that affect issues of pay equity? So anyway, one disaster at a time is what I'm saying.
I'm sure it's very exhausting to sit in these long meetings, but I guess it's better than BuzzFeed where they aren't showing up.
Yes. No. Meetings. And listen, in that regard, as challenging as some moments have been, you know, there are a lot of these media organizations that hire this terrible firm known as Jones Day, which are essentially known as media union busters. Right. I kind of think of them as democracy union busters because mm-hmm. when you destroy media, that's kind of what you're doing.
Right.
So Jones Day, I hope you're very proud of themselves. Also, they were recently hit with a pay equity suit. So Uh-oh. Go Jones Day. Go figure. They're paying their women less. So they hire these terrible firms that like Jones Day that won't even sit with you at the table. God forbid you try to even get management in the room. They will try to wear you down on everything. And I think in that regard, the lawyers that we've been working with, you know, certain things like we're going to be a closed shop. So in order to work at the LA Times, you have to be in the union, which gives the union more powerful and gives us a better negotiating strength. Mm-hmm. They agreed to a diversity clause. So that means every position that opens up, they have to interview at least two candidates from underrepresented groups, mm-hmm. all inspired by a Harvard Business Review's study called the Rooney Rule, where when you have one diverse candidate, usually they stand out so much they don't get the job. But when you have more than one, it levels the playing field.
Comes from football, a little bit. Right?
It comes from football. Wow. Mm-hmm. And so that part I don't know because I cover paintings. Yeah. But so they have shown a willingness, I think, to stretch in ways that, you know, other newsrooms and other media organizations have not. So I am happy for that, but the intellectual property one has been a toughie, and we're going to be working on the counter proposal to their counter proposal in the coming weeks.
I gotta say, hearing LA Times and closed shop in the same sentence is still kind of a fun novelty. Yeah. One of the biggest union busting entities in American history, probably.
General Otis is spinning in his grave. Also, the fact that his union is half run by a Latina is probably just killing his whole idea of a great white spot. Sorry, General.
Carolina, thank you so much for coming on the show. Please come back anytime.
Oh my God, I'm a big listener, so this is how I learn about what's happening in our hallowed city council chamber.
Oh, we should get in on. We should get some equity for that. If you're using our stories for your reporting,
I'll Venmo you $5 later.
Thank you for listening to LA Podcast. We'll be back next week. Bye. LA Podcast.
to hell.